after that is where we're going to pick up. We hit a little bit of this Sunday, but I want to put it all in together, verses 10 through 21. I think they stand as a unit. So let's look in verse 10. It says, "And Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. And the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, Where wilt thou that we will go and prepare that thou mayest eat the Passover? And he sendeth forth two of his disciples and saith unto them, Go ye into the city, and there shall meet you a man bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wheresoever he shall go in, say ye unto the goodman of the house, The master saith, Where is the guest chamber, where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room, furnished and prepared. There make ready for us. And his disciples went forth and came into the city and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And in the evening he cometh with the 12. And as they sat and did eat, Jesus said, Verily I say unto you, one of you which eateth with me shall betray me. And they began to be sorrowful and to say unto him one by one, Is it I? And another said, Is it I? And he answered and said unto them, It is one of the 12 that dippeth with me in the dish. The Son of Man indeed goeth, as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it for that man if he had never been born." So this whole section describes really what the chief priests and the Pharisees were really hoping for, longing for, not at that same time, but they were hoping to find some way that they might be able to, again, kill Christ, get rid of him, and do it behind the scenes. What better way to do that than have someone who's on the inside, right? I mean, Judas was part of the 12. He was an intimate companion with Christ. He knew his comings. He knew his goings. He knew where he was going to be. And to be honest with you, I think that kind of helps us make a little bit of sense of some of the responses, or at least the disciples, where they're going to have the Passover. So we know this, just based on what we've already read. We know that the chief priests, the scribes, wanted to kill Christ. This is the fourth time, I think, Mark has mentioned that in his gospel. We also know that Judas is ready to betray Christ. He's already made a deal with the scribes, the Pharisees. And then we know that Jesus knows that Judas is going to betray him. And the reason we know that is because he says it right here in the Passover, right? One of you that is sitting with me will betray me. So let's go back and just work our way a little slower through the text and make a few comments, particularly on some of the language and some of the things that might not just automatically jump out at us. I want to start in verse 12. It says, "The first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, Where wilt thou that we go and prepare that thou mayest eat the Passover? And he sendeth forth two of his disciples and saith unto them, Go ye into the city." Now let me say this first. The city of Jerusalem at this time, and this doesn't really add to the text as much as it adds to the scene, the city of Jerusalem at this time would have been packed. I think I was reading that it was 43 square miles was the how big the city of Jerusalem, that Jerusalem was. In Josephus's writings, he says in AD 66 that there were 2 million Jews crowded into Jerusalem at that time. It was just cram-packed. And so it was going to be really, really hard for these Pharisees to be able to do anything with Jesus that the crowds weren't going to see. You couldn't really go anywhere in Jerusalem without big crowds. So Jesus says, "Go into the city, and there shall meet you a man bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wheresoever he shall go in, say ye to the goodman, that is the master of the house, the master, that would be Jesus, has said, where is the guest chamber? And really in the Greek it is, where is my guest chamber? And the language there suggests that Christ already had prearranged this. Sometimes you might hear this commented on in proving maybe the foreknowledge of God or proving the sovereignty of Christ and his knowledge of knowing that this man was going to happen to have a pitcher of water and he was going to happen to go to a guy and he was going to happen to have a room. But the way it's worded in the original language, it's worded as if it was a prearranged thing. It's also worded, and it doesn't really take, you don't have to go to the Greek to figure this out. The answer that Jesus gives is a really vague, obscure answer, isn't it? What if you were to ask me, where are we going to eat? And I said, well, go to the third stop sign and take a left, and then you'll see a yard that has a cement cat in the garden, and go a little bit past it and take a right, and that'll be where we eat. And I was trying to tell you how to get to McDonald's. Well, that wouldn't make sense, would it? See, Jesus had a prearranged place that he was going to send these guys to. He knew where they were going to go. And as they ask him, where are we going to go? He says, you'll find a man with carrying water. That was a woman's job back then. So a man carrying water, a pot of water on his head, pitcher of water on his head, would have stood out. They would have been able to recognize that. And then he's going to take him to a house, and then the master of that house would have already prepared, according to what Jesus has to say here, would have already prepared a guest chamber for them. The preparations would have been made, not completely as far as the meal goes, but as far as the room goes. So what's the point? Well, I think it's very likely that what Jesus was doing here was that he was, in his sovereignty, he knew what Judas' intentions were. This would have been a very convenient time for Judas to come and to take Christ. And in this simple question that got a really vague answer, Jesus is saying, almost in an indirect way, I think, Judas, you may be the one to take me, but you're not doing it now. You see, it wasn't until the fullness of time came that Christ ever did anything, which means it wasn't until the God-prescribed time that anything ever happened to Christ, and we could extend that and say that anything ever happens to us. But just making a little more sense out of the passage as to why Jesus would have answered his disciples that way. You see, this is all leading to the cross, but it's leading to the cross not as a helpless Jesus who just gets swept up against his will, but as one who is sovereignly choosing when and where things are going to happen. And so he goes in, or he says, you'll go and you'll see the master of the house. He'll show you what to do. And then in verse 16 it says, the disciples went forth and came into the city and found as he had said unto them. And they made ready the Passover. And in the evening cometh with the 12. And as they sat and ate, Jesus said, verily I say unto you, one of you which eateth with me shall betray me. Now, when Jesus says this, he's not just saying it. The meaning is not just simply the one who's going to betray me is here. But what Jesus is saying is the one who will betray me is a table companion. You know, eating with someone even now in a Middle Eastern culture, but at this point even more probably, that was a sign of intimacy. That was a sign of friendship, companionship. You remember what they said earlier in Mark, the condemnation that, why in the world is he eating with sinners? Well, they weren't so much worried about the fact that Jesus happened to put food in his mouth in the same geographical location as sinners, as much as they were saying, he accepts these people. He's identifying with these people. He's being hospitable with these people. He's being cordial with these people. You only eat with your friends. And so Jesus says, I'm going to be betrayed, and it's one of you who are eating with me. It's one of my intimate companions. And it says about the disciples, they began to be sorrowful and to say unto him one by one, is it I? And another said, is it I? And really, in the Greek, what they're saying is, this is literally the way the phrase would be spoken. They're saying, it's not I, is it? Or it's not me, is it? It's a question that begs an answer. It's not just that they're saying to themselves in their minds, it's not me, is it? Or, I wonder who it is. Surely it's not going to be me. But they're verbally saying to Jesus, it says, one by one, even Judas is saying, it's not me, is it? It's not me, is it? And he answered and he said unto them, it's one of the 12 that dippeth with me in the dish. And in John 13, 26 through 30, we know that what happens there is that Jesus does dip in the dish and he hands that sop to Judas and tells him, what you do quickly. And Judas got up and went. Now, here's really the weight of this whole section in verse 21. The Son of Man indeed goeth as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it for that man if he had never been born. This is what Jesus says. Again, reiterating in the first part, God's sovereignty, and then emphasizing in the second part, the responsibility of man or the responsibility of Judas. And we'll go to some other passages that show us that that hits us all, the responsibility of man. The Son of Man indeed goeth as it is written of him. Now, the last several messages we've emphasized, tried to put an emphasis on the sovereignty of God because it's in the text. As we finish out the Gospel of Mark, we'll probably say more about the sovereignty of God because the event that we're leading up to as we end Mark is the most significant event in human history that took place at just the right time and was prophesied about thousands of years before it happened in minute detail leading up to the event, and all of that spells out the sovereignty of God. It's the most significant event, not just in world history, but it's the most significant event that has ever occurred in my life and in your life, because this event is why we're here this afternoon, right? This event is why we can be called, or why we call ourselves, Christians, because Christ on the cross accomplished redemption for us in real time, in history, as a real person that took place in a real historical setting. And so, when we come to the New Testament, or when we come to one of the Gospels, it's not just like it's a novel that somebody's making up the details as they go. But these are things that actually happened. And we have words that Christ actually spoke. And in verse 21, really the weight of the whole passage from verse 10 down, it's leading up to this, the Son of Man indeed goeth. Christ says, someone's going to betray me. And essentially what he's saying is, and I'm not going to stop them. I'm not going to do anything about it. Because the Son of Man indeed goeth, as it is written of him. You see, Jesus says this was always going to happen. It was always going to happen. It was always supposed to happen. As a matter of fact, without the Son of Man going, the Bible makes no sense. You can't make sense out of the Old Testament, and you sure can't make sense out of the New Testament outside of this pivotal event that occurs as Jesus says, the Son of Man goeth as it is written of him. And so, in God's sovereignty, he says, this event will occur. But, Jesus says, woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it for that man if he had never been born. Now, there's some interesting things to think about when we think about, especially the last statement. Because we all know, I don't know that we've ever plugged this word in as to actually what happened, but we all know that once they go into the Garden of Gethsemane, that Christ is not just betrayed by one of his disciples, right? They all tuck tail and run. They all leave him. Peter's confronted and he's asked about whether or not he identifies with Christ, and he says he never knew the man. And so it's not just Judas that betrays Christ. Whenever the pressure is put on out of fear, out of weakness, out of just the pressure of the moment, all of the disciples forsake Jesus. All of the disciples really betray Jesus. But they all didn't do it in a planned and premeditated way. They all didn't do it out of greed. And they all didn't do it, really, out of maliciousness. You say, well, what's your point? Well, the point is this. When Christ speaks about this here in this setting, and he's speaking about Judas in verse 21, it's not that as followers of Christ, or it's not that the other disciples were in and of themselves any better than Judas at all. They were weak. They were fearful. They couldn't handle the pressure. But the faith that Christ had imparted into those disciples was stronger than their love of money. For Peter, it was eventually stronger than his fear of man. And for the disciples, it was that which would eventually grow until just a few years down the road, they would be talking about these men who were weak and fearful and so forth and so on and say they're turning the whole world upside down. But not Judas. They wouldn't say that about Judas. Because Judas, he loved money. He worshipped money. He made an idol out of money. We know that just because whenever it talks about in the last section that we read in Mark 14, as this woman comes and she breaks this alabaster box of ointment and pours it on Christ, it says that the disciples became indignant. In John, it mentions Judas particularly. And Judas says, we could have used this money and we could have fed a lot of folks. And then they put that little statement in parentheses, and it tells us that what got in Judas's crawl about this whole thing was that he was the one who was in charge of the money bag. And Judas liked to dip out of that money bag. He enjoyed skimming a little off the top every now and then. And so it wasn't the fact that he wanted to give money to the poor. It was the fact that Judas saw, here's a year's wages. I could skim off this and have a pretty good chunk. But instead, she just wasted it on the Lord. And so as we look at this whole scene and we look at the whole reality of God's sovereignty and man's responsibility, I think R.C. Sproul gives a really helpful statement about this, just as far as how all this works in this part of the narrative. He says this, it's not as though God in his sovereignty coerced Judas to carry out the evil act of betraying Jesus. Rather, the sovereign God worked his will in and through the choices of his creatures. Judas did exactly what Judas wanted to do. But God brought good out of evil, redemption out of treachery. And so when we're talking about God's sovereignty and man's responsibility, we have to understand that we're not saying that what God does is entices people to sin and then judges them for it. We're not saying that God tempts man and that God leads man into sin and then turns around and condemns man for what he was enticed to do. What we are saying is that God sovereignly removes his influence. God sovereignly removes his hedge of protection, his care, however you want to say it, and he lets man do what man was going to do anyway. And then in justice and in righteousness, God condemns them. You know, whenever we read about what happened with Pharaoh, they talk about Pharaoh's heart hardening twice. At one point it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And at another point it says Pharaoh hardened his heart. Well, what does God have to do to harden Pharaoh's heart? Well, he just has to remove all restraint, right? He just has to remove all restraint. So that really the question is, what does God have to do to give a sinner over to sin? Well, he just leaves him to his appetite. It's just like asking me, what do I have to do? What do I have to do to in order for my dog to eat the slop that we have left over after a meal? I just have to turn her loose. She goes there on her own. And she eats it all up on her own. Well, what does God do whenever he lets a sinner to himself? He lets him go, and the sinner just slops up all the sin he wants, right? That's what we're naturally inclined to do. And so one of the things that I want to mention here, because we could get into some pretty sticky discussions about, you know, sometimes people talk about trying to balance out the sovereignty of God and the responsibility of man, and it's just such a hairline deal, and how do you balance the whole thing out? Well, first off, I just want to say this. I think it is I understand what people say when they're saying it, but I think it is theologically inaccurate to talk about trying to balance out God's sovereignty with man's responsibility. Because you don't balance those two things out. Man's responsibility exists within the sovereignty of God. God has sovereignly said we are responsible. Now, what he does in his secret will is a secret, right? So we can't balance out the things that God has not revealed to us with what he expects of us. You see, categorically, that didn't make any sense, does it? And so sometimes we get really busy trying to discover things or trying to balance out things or try to think about things in categories that they don't really exist in. And so there is no balance there. We are responsible. God is sovereign. And while we could put in a few more details, the Bible does not split hairs on that to give us just a crystal clear picture as to how it works outside of saying God's sovereign and you're responsible. Another thing that I think is worth noting is that whenever Jesus talks about this in verse 21, he just states the facts, right? He doesn't try to go into a lot of explanation. He just states the facts. This was always going to happen, and woe unto him who made it happen, in a sense. And so let's look at the first part. Let's look at the first part. The Son of Man indeed goeth, even as it is written. Now, we've said this already, but I just want to say it again. That when we get to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, number one, it was sovereignly appointed by God. And we can find it going all the way back to Genesis 3:15. All the way back there. And then throughout the scriptures coming up. Now, we're not going to go to a ton of scriptures this evening, just for time's sake. But in the Old Testament, through types, through shadows, just explicit teaching about Christ, through prophecies, in the Psalms, you'll see where Christ was. It was written of him. He's all in the Old Testament. And so this is a sovereign appointment by God. And again, the most significant event in history. Now, let me go to a few places here to talk about this idea that when we look at the cross, we're looking at the most significant event that will ever take place, that has ever taken place. You say, well, what about the second coming? Well, outside of the crucifixion of Christ, the second coming means nothing but judgment for us, right? So look in Philippians 2. Look in Philippians 2. And I don't go here as much for some kind of way to try to argue in your mind that this is significant, because I don't think that you think it is. But I go here, hopefully, to just put in our minds that if this really is the event of all events, we ought to be meditating on this more, shouldn't we? We ought to be wanting to know more and more and more about what exactly took place, not just in the sense that at the cross my sins were forgiven, but what all went on here. This is an important thing for God, an important event for God. As a matter of fact, this is where we see God's glory on display. Look in Philippians 2, starting in verse 8, after it talks about Jesus humbling himself, coming in the form of a servant. In verse 8 it says, "And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God hath also highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Here he talks about and he connects the crucifixion of Christ with the exaltation of Christ and the glory of the Father. He came, he humbled himself, he took upon himself the form of a servant, he became obedient unto death, and God exalted him and gave him a name above every name, so that one day every knee would bow, every tongue would confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father. Why? Because of the crucifixion. Because of the accomplishment of redemption on the cross. Because on the cross, Jesus Christ took the burden, took the weight of my sins and of your sins and of the sins of all of God's elect, and he paid for them. And we know that, and we've heard that. But I want you to think about, if you've ever had a guilty conscience, if you just ever experienced even the effects of the guilt that you have brought upon yourself through sin. You know, guilt can be a heavy thing to carry around, and the burden of guilt, as far as the consequences that come from our sin, can be hellish at times. And what Christ did was take every sin of every one of his people, and he took that on himself, and he satisfied that. Satisfied it, the full weight. And so what happens? It says God gives him a name above every other name. Look in Revelation 5. This chapter opens up with a throne and a book that's written, and no one can open it. It's sealed, no one can open it. John begins to weep because no one can open it. And then a lamb occurs or comes, and he opens the book, opens the seals. And look in verse 8. "And when he had taken the book, the four beasts and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps and golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sung a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by the blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on earth." This is the new song that they're singing in heaven. And why is this the new song? Because he is the Lamb who was slain and who has redeemed us through his blood. You see, the central event that makes sense out of the old, makes sense out of the new, and that gives us purpose in the present, gives us hope in the present. And this was written, Jesus says, "The Son of Man must go as it is written of him." Look in Psalm 22. Psalm 22. Just a couple of examples here where we see the death of Christ written of. Here we find even the very words and the very events that surrounded Christ's crucifixion being told long before Christ was ever born. Look what David writes. Psalm 22, And I'm going to hop around, but I want to start with verse 1. He says, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring?" Well, if you're familiar with the Gospels at all, you realize these are the very words that rolled off of the lips of Christ as he's hanging on the cross, right? Word for word. Now, go to verse 14. "I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. And thou hast brought me into the dust of death. For dogs have compassed me, and the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I may tell all my bones, they look and stare upon me. They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. But be not thou far from me, O Lord, O my strength. Haste thee to help me." The description that's being given here is a description of the very scene of Christ on the cross. These things happened, right? They pierced his hands, they pierced his feet, they parted his garments. He was poured out like water in the sense that he was under horrific physical stress. "My tongue cleaveth to my jaw, and thou hast brought me into the dust of death. Dogs have compassed me, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me." Outside of just a few folks, the people who were around Christ during his crucifixion, if they lived long enough, they were part of the same people who were utterly destroyed by the judgment of God in AD 70. The wicked had compassed him. "As it is written," Jesus says, "as it is written." And then here's a familiar one that you'll all know in Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 says, "Who has believed our report," starting in verse 1, "and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness. And when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He's despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed." Isaiah here, at least, I don't know how deep his understanding was, but as far as what he's teaching and what he's writing, he's talking about the imputed righteousness of Christ on our behalf and our sin being imputed to Christ on the cross. "All we like sheep have gone astray, and we have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He's brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is dumb, so he opened not his mouth." And then I want to stop there, although the whole chapter is a prefigure. It's talking about the crucifixion of Christ. And so Jesus says, as it's written, this is going to happen. Not only do we see in that the sovereignty of God, but we see the love of Christ, don't we? Jesus is walking on the earth as a man. He's serving. He's being falsely accused. He has plots of averted different plots where folks wanted to murder him, wanted to kill him. They wanted to get him out of the temple. They wanted to get rid of him. He brought a man back from the dead. They wanted to kill Christ for doing that. They wanted to kill the guy that he brought back from the dead, Lazarus. They wanted to get rid of the evidence as well. And yet it says of Christ that he set his face like flint toward Jerusalem. In other words, he was dead set on going to Jerusalem, even though he knew that as he went to Jerusalem, in his own words, "This is the reason why I came, to go to Jerusalem and to die." And why did he do that? Well, he did it for God's glory. But where does God receive glory in that? In expressing his mercy and grace towards sinners. Right? I mean, the what we've been talking about being the event of all events in history is the event that shows that God is just, and yet God is full of grace and mercy toward his people. And if God would give his only son, what would he withhold from us? And so he says, as it is written, the Son of Man indeed goeth. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good were it for that man if he had never been born. What's Christ saying here? Essentially what he's saying is this. Judas Iscariot is 100% responsible for what he's about to do, even though it falls under the sovereign plan of God. You see, there have been some who have said, well, you know, Judas, he was just kind of playing the role. You know, it was just a actors on a stage kind of thing. So surely God couldn't condemn Judas for doing what he had sent Christ to accomplish. Judas was the one that delivered him to the chief priest. He had to be delivered to the chief priest in order for him to be crucified. And so, you know, somewhere in the middle, you know, Judas is just doing what God wanted to happen. Well, while God does override and God does use Judas to do that, in God's sovereign plan, he's never been pleased with anyone who's done anything out of selfish greed, ambition, and idolatry, really. All we have to do, and we did this last time, so we won't do it this time, but all we have to do is go down and see how the Bible talks about Judas, how Judas is remembered. He's the son of perdition, the son of destruction. He's the son of the devil. It would have been better for him if he had not been born. You know, you can't say that of anyone who's a child of grace, right? You can't say that of anyone, no matter what kind of a sin they fall into. But look in Matthew 18. In Matthew 18, starting in verse 6, Jesus says this, "But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." You see what Jesus does here? He does the exact same thing that he did in Mark 14. He says, woe unto the world because offenses come and offenses must come. In other words, you're not going to get around that. In God's sovereignty, there will be offenses that come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. You know what that means? That means you and I are responsible for what we do. That's what it means. Now, that doesn't mean that our actions can be greater than God's grace. That doesn't mean that we ultimately fall away. But it does mean this. What you do matters. Sometimes people have this idea, well, you know what, the Lord, I think, has done a work in my life, and so it doesn't really matter what I do now. You know, the rest of it's just kind of icing on the cake. I can do whatever I want to do, however I want to do it, and it doesn't matter. Well, that's not the way Jesus sees it. It's not the way he sees it. Offenses are going to come, but woe unto you, by whom the offenses come. You know, he even goes in a little more detail than this as far as generalities go. Look in Matthew 12. So essentially in Matthew 18, he's saying you are accountable to God for what you do. The offenses that you act out, the offenses that you commit are not insignificant. They're not just throwaways. Look in Matthew 12, verse 35. He says, a good man out of the good treasure of the heart bringeth forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. Now, Jesus starts out in verse 35, just giving the illustration that we're all familiar with. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth good things. In other words, a good tree brings forth good fruit. A bad tree brings forth bad fruit. That's easy enough to understand. And then in verse 36, he says, but I say unto you, in other words, when Jesus says that phrase, I say unto you, he's saying, listen up, that every idle word that men speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. What's Jesus saying? He's saying what you say matters. He's saying that what we say, one of these days, we're going to give an account to God for. It's pretty sobering, isn't it? That's not really even the depth of the weight of what he's saying. He's saying every idle word, that is, every little throwaway word, you know, every word that we've mumbled under our breath, every word that we've just kind of muttered and thought nobody heard it, you're going to give an account to God for that. What about those words that we intentionally knew were going to hurt other folks? What about those words that we knew were intentionally going to offend other folks? Well, of course, we're going to give an account for those too, right? The point that Jesus is making is that none of this stuff is going to escape the view and the knowledge of God. And then the greater point that he's making is this: you're responsible. I'm responsible. For what? I'm responsible. Look at the phrases that goes down. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. So if it's true that a good tree brings forth good fruit, and a bad tree brings forth bad fruit, but let's stick with the good part. If it's true that a good tree brings forth good fruit, and we say that we're good trees, if we're born of the Spirit, right? If we're born of God, we're good trees. We've been made good trees by God. And yet, as good trees, we're bringing forth bad fruit, then our claim is not justified, is it? In other words, it's completely incongruent, right? If I claim to be born of the Spirit of God, and yet the fruit that is coming out of me that I'm producing is not fruit of the Spirit, but it's really the fruit of the flesh. I'm not walking in the Spirit, I'm walking in the flesh. If that habitually continues, there's no real justification for me to believe that I'm a good tree. Why? Because good trees bring forth good fruit. That's not hard to understand, is it? It is sobering, isn't it? So what does it mean? Does it mean if I think I'm a good tree and I start bringing forth good fruit that I lost my good tree? No. But if I claim to be a good tree and I never bring forth any good fruit at all, I may not have ever been a good tree to begin with. You see, that's what he's saying. He's not saying you become justified before God. He's saying your claim is either justified or falsified. That's pretty sobering, isn't it? What does it mean? It means we're responsible. It means there aren't any throwaway actions. It means there aren't any throwaway words. All those little idle words put Christ on the cross, right? I mean, he died for every single one of the little idle words of his people that were sinful. And so we can't think of those as being insignificant unless the cross is insignificant. And it's not. And then in 2 Corinthians 5, and this will be the last place I go, second to the last place I go, in 2 Corinthians 5, starting in verse 9, Paul says, wherefore we labor that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. And what Paul's saying here is, we labor that whether we are alive or dead, our goal is that we would please God. Then he goes on and says this, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. Now, what does it mean, and how is all this going to work? I mean, how does it work that when we are justified by the blood of Christ, we're going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ? How does all that work? I'll just be honest with you and tell you, I don't know exactly how all that's going to work, detail-wise. What I do know is that Paul's pretty confident that we all must stand before the judgment seat of Christ one of these days. I don't know the details of it. I don't know exactly how everything in that's going to come to place. But what I do know is this. What I do and what you do matters. It matters. It's significant. It's significant enough that one of these days we're going to give an account for it. And then in Romans chapter 9, when we get to Romans 9, starting in verse 14, this is after he's gone through and he's talked about the fact that God loved Jacob, but he hated Esau. Verse 14, he says, "What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. For he saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. For the scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and on whom he will, he hardeneth." Verse 19, "Thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will?" You see what the question is that Paul either anticipates, or the question that Paul has already come face to face with. So you're talking about God hated Esau and he loved Jacob and he raised Pharaoh up so that he might show his might, and he hardened Pharaoh. And the question is, well, if God's sovereign, who in the world has resisted his will, and how in the world could God find fault in someone? And look how Paul answers that question. "Nay, but, O man, who art thou that thou repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had afore prepared unto glory?" Now, I just want to stop there. When Paul gets to when Paul gets to 19 and says, your question is, if God's sovereign, how in the world can he find fault? Who's resisted his will? Paul says this: God is God and we are not. That's his answer, essentially. God is God and we are not. Does the potter not have power over the clay? Does the creator not have power over what he has created? Does God not have the right to make one vessel unto mercy and to make one vessel fitted for wrath? And the answer to every one of those questions is, let God be true and every man a liar. Right? God can do what he wants to do. And yet, I would also say that while that is true, we can't find fault with God, that the Bible also reveals enough to let us know that we're not left in limbo thinking that God draws men away and entices men to sin, and that God puts it in our hearts to sin against him. That's not the biblical teaching on that subject, right? God is light. In him is no darkness. He can't be tempted with evil. Neither tempteth he any man. But we are all tempted when we are drawn away of what? Our own desires. Our own desires. And so, as we go back to Mark 14. And we see the unfolding of Christ making his way to the cross. Then we see in verse 21 that the Son of Man goes as it's written. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Good work for that man if he had never been born. In God's sovereignty, he will overrule this for good, and redemption will take place. But in man's responsibility, Judas Iscariot will be judged for the wickedness that he commits on that night. And so may we remember, number one, that in God's sovereignty, he can overrule any act of wickedness that's ever intended anywhere. So we think about that again. We think about things like ISIS. We think about things like world powers. And we think about little moments and little people in our own lives. But then may we also remember this. Our responses and our actions are significant, and they're significant to God. They ought to be significant to us. And so may we be faithful, not sinless, but faithful to deal with our sin in a God-prescribed way and to strive for holiness.
Thank you for listening to this message. Our prayer is that you've been blessed by the messages and the daily devotional blog on sermon audio from Ripley Primitive Baptist Church. We would love the opportunity to be of greater service to you and your walk with Christ. In other words, we would like to get to know you better. Do you have need of counsel, of a home church, or can we just pray for you? Please feel free to contact us by phone at 662-837-8590 or visit our website at www.ripleypbc.com.